One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
I'm Richard Dolan, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. I am delighted to be joined by a returning guest, a historian, researcher, and author of multiple groundbreaking books, even, here to discuss his latest work, A History of USOs, Volume 1, Beginnings to 1969. Welcome back to the podcast, Mr. Richard Dolan. Richard, welcome.
Hi, Andy. Thank you. I'm excited to be here. Glad to be
here. Good to have you on, and congratulations on the book. For those on YouTube, I'm going to do that thing of holding it up and going, I've got the hardcover here, and we'll get to the various editions of it. But beautiful book, and I know the shout out to the illustrator, Alan Levine, beautifully illustrated cover and the contents inside of it as well. Richard, you must be pleased with the final product.
I'm very happy with this, Andy. It was a lot of work going into it. This was a 3-year project. This, including the two volumes that are following, which will be following up pretty soon. But yes, it exceeded everything I'd hoped to be honest. And you mentioned Alan Levine, the illustrator. He did beautiful illustrations that are throughout that book. The cover actually was directed by Tracy, and we had a different artist, and Alan's in illustrations are inside. But it came out. It was far more than what I set out to accomplish when I began. So I didn't expect to get into the big statistical analysis. I didn't expect a lot of things to come out of it when I started compared with what has happened. So I'm very happy.
Yeah, well, let's get into it because we've got a lot to cover here, Richard. And I'm going to start off with a really simple but important question, because I think I mentioned this to Danny Sheehan just recently. Over the last few months, there has been such a lot of change in the UFO conversation, not to say the least politically in the United States, and we'll get to that later on. There's a lot of new eyes and ears on the UFO topic for a lot of reasons. So people listening to this know what a UFO is, but what is a USO? And why the focus on that particular aspect of the conversation?
Think water UFO, or think water-based UAP. USO stands for Unidentified Submerged Objects. In fact, that's an acronym that's gone through its own little variations over the years, but it's a water-based UFO, to keep it as simple as possible. So an object that is seen operating in an anomalous or an unusual way in the water, in a way that doesn't make sense relating to our technology, or what we know exists in the bodies of water, or an object that can enter or emerge from a body of water and act in what we now call transmedium ways. So that is, it can operate as easily in water as it does in air. And that's important because we as yet do not officially, and I think probably for real, don't have technology that can do that, can operate equally well in the water as well as the air. But a lot of these objects, in fact, many of them do, or they seem to, according to the report. So that's a USO. These are things, you know, we're used to talking about UFOs or UAP now in the air, in the atmosphere. We've been hearing a little bit more about these objects in the water. Those are USOs. And that indeed is what this these three volumes, as they will come out, are all about.
So why
the history of them.
Yeah. Why was it important for you then to focus on USOs? Because there might be some folks thinking, well, if we're aware of transmedium, if these things can operate under the water, in the air, and in the atmosphere and beyond, then aren't they all just the same thing? So why the focus?
Well, it's a great question. And in fact, there have been very, very few books that have focused on this water-based aspect of the phenomenon. It's been very few. In the English language, we didn't get our first one until around 1970. And then it took another three decades before we got the second one. So it's been very, very little. And then, you know, Russia has had one or two books on the subject. The Italian UFO organization's done has done some work on USOs, and there's been scattered, but it's been very little. But why is it important? I think it's important if for no other reason just than because it's so fascinating. I mean, I think inherently speaking, when one hears a story of an object emerging from a body of water and flying off, to me, that is even more fascinating, honestly, than watching hearing a story about a flying saucer that zigzags through the air. That's amazing too, but coming out of the oceans, going into the oceans, you instinctively wonder, what are they doing down there? The ocean is a great big mystery. It's an unknown to this day. I've learned a lot about the oceans in the course of doing this series. So 5% of all of our ocean volume, only 5% has been mapped to any scientific degree. 95% of the volume has not been. The ocean floor, we've done a little bit more. I think we've mapped to a high level of scientific precision, 20, 25%. But that means 75% of the ocean floor remains unmapped in a sophisticated way. So there's a lot that we don't know. And I started this 3 years ago in 2022 for my website, which is richardolamembers.com. I have a great community there, and I'll do posts of all different types, video or written articles, whatever. And I just started to do a few on USOs just because, and it became a very interesting little rabbit hole. The members of the site, I think, enjoyed them, and I enjoyed them, and I kept going all through the summer of 2022. I continued this. And the next thing I realized was I was doing a lot of research, hunting them down, realizing that all of these great USO cases were scattered in a variety of websites and books and magazines. There was not a single really good available repository of them. And I thought, well, let's see if I can do this. And can I actually can I bang out a history of it? I thought, and took a little longer than I thought, 3 years, but I went through a lot of different databases, which we can or don't have to go through, but it was meticulous. But for all that, it was fascinating and exciting. And I loved just about every minute of doing it.
The environment we're talking, obviously, with the ocean is incredibly difficult to see anything, to find anything. And that's going to be a big part, I'm sure, of your research, is how difficult was it to research USOs? You know, it's one thing to go out with a pair of binoculars or a night vision scope and look up at the sky, look at the stars. You can see something. You can see lights and satellites. But to even go and investigate USOs, you could stand next to the water or you could go on a boat. That's about it, isn't it? So how difficult was it researching the book and what you were finding?
Well, I'm a landlubber, I'll say that. I'm not much of a man of the sea. I've been out on the water many times, but I'm not a I'm not an expert at it. I would never pretend. So what I did, I was simply hunt for stories and reports as they existed. But I think your question, you know, is a really pertinent one. It's like, how often do we actually record these USOs, these types of sightings? Because you often hear researchers sometimes saying things like, oh, at least half of all UFO cases are connected to bodies of water. I've heard this so many times that I've forgotten how many. And honestly, that's just not true. I have not seen that to be the case in my research. It's a minority. In fact, a small minority of cases. When I go through the vast numbers of UFO or UAP cases that are out there, to find one that actually, where you find a craft engaging in some way with a body of water, is rare. It's rare. It's a minority of them, but it's an important subset. And I feel it does deserve to be handled, because one of the reasons that I think there are few of them is simply because we're just, as you say, not out on the water. I strongly suspect that there are many more USO cases out there than what we're getting. For these three volumes, I've collected 672 of them. Sounds like a lot, but I went through probably, I read probably through 10,000 or so, I'm guessing, prospective cases until I selected these. So, and even those that I selected, I was looking for USO cases. I wasn't just looking at random. So I was very selective. But I do think that there are probably more, there's more going on than we're recording. One good way to see that is I created a map of every USO that I put into this book. So I have Google Earth, and I put little yellow pins on the map to track them. And the large number of these occur near the shore, near some nation's coastline. There are definitely cases that I was able to record where they're out in the middle of the Pacific or Atlantic Ocean, but that's much fewer. And of course, you know, the old joke, guys under a streetlight on the ground on his hands and knees looking for something, and a stranger says, "What are you looking for?" "Oh, my car keys, I lost them." "Oh, okay, well, I'll help you. Where do you think you left them?" "Oh, over there where it's dark, but the light's better here."
Yeah.
So I was kind of botched that. But anyway, the idea is that we're on the shore. We're not out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean most of the time. So, of course, we're not going to see them. You do have navies, the U.S. Navy, the Russian Navy, some other navies are out there. The U.K. Navy has caught some of these out at sea, but they don't like to talk. So it's very difficult to know how much is out there. I believe that there's much more than what I've been able to find. Another reason I think this is, particularly with military cases, a very common way that I would find a military case, because most of those are not through freedom of information. There are a number of the cases I've written about that are fully backed by declassified, usually U.S. government archives, but by some government, but a lot of them are not. But a typical Navy case would be some guy 20, 30, sometimes 40 years after the fact, writing to some online journal or submitting it to the National UFO Reporting Center or someplace like that. And he'll say, "Yes, back in 1960, whatever, I was aboard this ship and we had this thing happen. And I'm only talking about it now." That is very typical. That's a very, very typical type of a thing. And it's understandable. So I happily include those types of cases. I try to use my best judgment to decide, is this a strong case? Is this not a strong case? I actually created an evidence ranking system for these cases, which I discuss at some length in the book. But, you know, I'm trying to, my number one goal for these, honestly, Andy, was I was aware that there are all of these events, I don't even like to call them cases sometimes, because they're encounters that happened to a person or to people. In that first volume that you have there, most of those witnesses are not even alive anymore. But they had an extraordinary thing happen to them that not only is are these cases forgotten, in many instances, they've never been remembered to begin with. And I thought, this is terrible. This is not right. I know there's a lot of aerial UFO encounters that have been forgotten just the same. But I thought, well, I could try to do justice to these water-based encounters. That would be a good thing. And I really wanted, more than almost anything else in this book, to just breathe some life into these completely forgotten cases. I think those people who experienced them deserve to have their stories told. And these are important events, frankly, if I can say this, in the history of our species and the history of our planet. I mean, when you stop and think about what I'm trying to describe here, you've got people on a boat sometimes in an ocean, an object comes out of the water, hovers over their boat, circles around, their electronics go haywire. Once in a while, they're missing some time at the end. The craft goes away. How is that not an extraordinary, incredible occurrence that needs to be preserved? And so that was really my number one goal, to do that and to do it in a way that was worthy of the case or the event itself. And fortunately, I had a wonderful illustrator, Alan Levine, who did just a superb job in illustrating many of these cases.
Yeah, there's some beautiful prints that could come out of some of those pictures as well for your wall in the background. Or how did you decide on how far back to go? Because I think when you're looking at any UFO, USO, UAP case, there are time periods where you can look and think, if it's maybe from the 80s onwards, there's a certain quality of data. You can go back to the 50s and 60s, more paperwork, potentially some grainy video or photographs. After that, it starts to become more testimony-based, perhaps some radar data from the kind of World War periods. But then you're going back centuries here where you're truly relying on testimony. And how do you decide, I'm going to stop here, because even the language used at the time, and I wonder, even when I saw you were going back that far, people talking about, and I hesitate to mention things like this, but I will for a reason, things like mermaids or giant sea monsters. A couple of hundred years ago, people didn't have the terminology for flying saucers, discs, aliens, NHI, UAP. They were just describing something strange in the water. So how did you kind of come to terms with how far back to go?
Great question. I tried to go back as far as the data would allow me. So I looked at, I went back thousands of years and looking for what I thought could be genuine USO cases. I actually did, so the earliest official case that I've included that I have like a case designation for only occurred in 1717, a little more than 300 years ago. And I think that's actually a pretty good case, in fact. But there are earlier potential cases that I do include and I discuss in this book, particularly in the first chapter, which is all dedicated to the idea of ancient USOs. And I really did try to go into it. For example, I did a write-up of the sighting by Christopher Columbus just before he landed in Hispaniola in Santo Domingo, the New World. Because there was, Columbus and one member of his crew saw a very unusual light, as in 1492. And I really tried to ask, like, was this a genuine USO or not? And I leave that one open, by the way. I think it's not readily understood conventionally, but it's kind of a vague sighting, and it could be explained by something that they saw on land. It's hard to know. But I looked at earlier cases. There's a number of 10th century, 11th century Chinese cases I discussed. They are potential USO cases. There are a few even earlier. In fact, Alan did a nice rendition of one that took place in Ireland, allegedly, in the year 597. And I wrote about this. I personally don't think that it's a legitimate USO case. The thing about these earlier potential cases is that when you read them carefully, you find a lot of questions about them. In fact, I discussed one that took place in, I think it was Bristol in the 1661, right after the English Civil War. And I have a bit of a conversation about it. And in fact, when you read that case officially, it's like Skye's describing by the River Severn, something that similar to the kites that the young boys fly these days, 1661. So you're thinking angular, you're thinking, oh, it's interesting, it seems mechanical. But then this object took the shape of a man pacing back and forth, and then it took the shape of a man on horseback, galloping back and forth, and then it took the shape of a beautiful woman in a robe of some sort. And to me, this is clearly symbolic, and it very likely had more to do with the end of the English Civil War than any actual sighting. I don't know of what object is going to take the shape of basically Oliver Cromwell, and then King Charles, and then a woman who's probably a personification of peace or grace or something like that. That's how I read it. So these are not cases that I feel that one can work with. I tried to find them, but I just, I tried to be careful as well. And so the earliest case that struck me as reliable and that I could trust was not until 1717 off the coast of Martinique by a French ship that was in the Caribbean at the time.
You mentioned a couple of things there about potentially objects, what they could be. When it comes to UFOs, there are the typical misidentifications of it's a bird, it's a misidentified aircraft. Nowadays, Starlink satellites, commercial drones, the list goes on, I think. But as you go back further, or even use the environment of water now, what are some of the key misidentifications you think people would come across in your research over the water?
Well, there's a few things. When I'm looking at any case, whether it's a contemporary one or an old case, of course, in the context of USOs, you're looking for things that are truly unusual or hopefully anomalous, things that just don't make sense on the face of it, on the face of the testimony and description. So, for example, there is a case, an early one in that book from 1825, not far from Hawaii by an English vessel. A really good case. In my opinion, it's a great case because we have the name of the man who recorded it. He was the ship's doctor. His name was Andrew Bloxham. He wrote a detailed journal entry at the time describing what happened on August, 11th of 1825. At 3:30 in the morning, he said, an object described as like a red cannon shot comes out of the water. It's glowing brightly, so bright, he said, you could pick a pin off the deck of the ship at 3:30 a.m. It rises, it's there for a bit, it lowers into the water, and then it does it a second time, rises and lowers into the water twice. So you're left with this. Now, if it was just one time, perhaps you could envision a naturalistic explanation. I don't even know what that would be. What kind of bright, glowing, orangey orb emerges from the ocean for a number of seconds, lighting up your ship brighter than daylight, essentially, and then you're returning. But to do it twice, we're now relying on the testimony of this man. Do we trust him? That is ultimately the question. Do we trust his authenticity, his reliability? I decide, yes, I think that I do. He was the doctor of the ship. He had ship's logs that were quite extensive. And he writes this one particular entry. That's unusual. So I read that. I think, yes, I'm going to include that. And in fact, I consider it a pretty good case. And also, I look for patterns, or I've come to look for patterns. It so happens that there are a fairly large number of USO cases that are marked by glowing orange-like spherical objects that are seen to emerge from the water or hovering very, very low above the water. It's quite a large number of them. It's a significant subset. So what Andrew Bloxham wrote in his journal of 1825 would fit in quite well with sightings that occurred 150 or more years later.
I was going to ask you just on that, good timing. So you mentioned those orbs within the book. Are there any types of objects or craft that seem to be more exclusive to water than we would find over land or on land? Is there any recurring themes?
That's a fantastic question. No, what I found are the shapes and the types of objects described could be described as any ordinary, I say ordinary, any UFO or UAP. So you get a few different types. Gray, silver, metallic, disc-like objects, flying saucers, were common as USOs. Cigar-shaped objects, which you often get as classic UFOs, these also are USOs, many of them. Orbs or spheres, very common. Particularly when they glow, they're almost all inevitably an orangish type of color. Not always, but predominantly so. Sometimes white, sometimes a few other colors, but orange is quite common. There are a small number of triangular USOs. Just as really, even with aerial sightings, triangles still tend to be somewhat of a minority, although they're a larger minority for aerial sightings. For water-based, the USOs that I have found, and again, I'm only going off of what I have been able to find, they're maybe 5% of the total. They're fairly small, but they are significant because there are remarkable consistencies in these descriptions. So for example, triangles for USOs are nearly always described as black, which is very common for aerial triangular UFOs as well. So that's a consistent thing. Other types of objects, some are just described only as a source of light. The witness wasn't able to determine if there was a shape or something behind that. It's not unusual. That could be a sphere, that could be a light affixed to some other object of some other shape. There's a lot that we just don't know. But I would say that the USOs are fundamentally not of a different shape than the classic aerial UAP.
So it's safe to say there's a correlation then between the shape and the environment, or there isn't, sorry, because you're seeing them on the same things people are reporting in the atmosphere, in the air, and underwater. So then it begs the question, why that environment, why the water? For you, is it a question of origin?
Well, we're speculating here. You know, why are they in the water? What is the purpose? And this, I can't say that I know, but I do. I'm happy to speculate about this, and I do as well in this book. The water has. I learned some of this from really listening and talking to Carl Knuth, who's an American academician who's talked a little bit about USOs of late. I really like Kevin Knuth.
Yeah,
and he. Stated, he said, you know, there's a lot of advantages to the water. Water, first of all, if you are from elsewhere, water can protect from radiation that may be harmful. Water can protect against rapid temperature fluctuations. It's much more consistent. It will protect against variations of pressure. It will provide an insulating surface in many ways. But also, if you're watching these busy, industrious, smart humans who notice everything, it's a much more secure environment. The humans still haven't really been able to penetrate all through all parts of the ocean depth. So if you really had the ability to operate down there and you could do it without much of a problem, it could be advantageous in many ways for security. Something that makes sense to me. I actually think, you know, when I study UFO reports, not just USO, but all UFO reports, which I do frequently, I am struck by the fact that they are worldwide every day. And of course, this is not to say that all reported UAP are anomalous alien craft. Of course, I know that's not true, but there's a lot that are very, very anomalous and very difficult to explain, and they happen around the world all the time. To me, that signifies an intelligence that has an interest in this entire world. That suggests to me that they are interested in what we human beings are probably doing, since we are massively important in terms of our effect on this planet. I mean, we have the ability to engage in nuclear war. And even though I'm sure these other beings are well ahead of us in all kinds of technological means, if we were to have a nuclear war, that probably would affect them as well. And so I could imagine they're interested in what we're doing. So therefore, I think ocean-based headquarters activity, that wouldn't surprise me if that's what they are doing.
Your first few words that you started there was, if you are from elsewhere, it would be advantageous potentially. I mean, there's an argument that being from here, it would be advantageous for us to be able to be in the water or have evolved to be under the water. And does that give any credence again to the speculation that potentially these things are from here and they're not using it as a base necessarily? I don't know if that goes back
that
to
they live here,
Atlantean. We're going into the kind of the abyss type scenario here.
Yeah, we're getting toward what might be called the crypto-terrestrial thesis. I think I do address this in the conclusion of the book. I actually have a bit of a discourse on it. I think it's in my conclusion. I'm not particularly warm to the idea, but I couldn't rule it out. The idea of a crypto-terrestrial or a kind of independently evolving, let's say, human-like civilization that exists in the water, strictly speaking in the water, I don't know what evidence I could speak to that would attest to it, or even what logic or how that would have happened. I can't say that I'm ruling it out. I could not say that. My assumption is that, A, I'm not really finding many persuasive ancient USO accounts to begin with. I have looked. I have really tried to. When I started this research, I assumed that I would find a couple of decent ancient ones. And I didn't, to my satisfaction. I just did not. There's some pretty good ancient aerial UFO sightings that I find interesting, but I wasn't able to say the same for water-based. So I don't know for a fact that there's even been a longstanding oceanic presence. It's possible. I mean, for most of our history, really up until the 15th, 16th century, human beings were not in the business of crossing the oceans anyway. Mm. The Mediterranean Sea was active. The Arabian Sea, you know, that part of the Indian Ocean there, was somewhat active. The South China Sea, a little bit here and there. But the mass of the Atlantic and Pacific and the mass of the Indian Ocean, no. We were not really exploring them or over them to any significant degree. So it's really hard to know. But I'm just not seeing a strong argument to say they have been here all along. They have evolved here. We're now bumping into them. It's possible. At times, when I was writing this book, particularly in some of the chapter introductions, for each chapter, I try to provide a historical context for a lot of the cases. I do speculate, you know, in the 19th and 20th centuries, our society, our species advanced so dramatically with our capability to explore the ocean. It wasn't really until the 1870s, not long ago, that we even started the science of oceanography, of really methodically trying to understand what's down there. So if you were an oceanic presence at that time or earlier, you never had to worry about human beings.
Yeah.
And so I do wonder if there was some kind of operation that was there. They operated securely for eons or for centuries or for however long. Starting in the 20th century, they had to pay attention to us. And so I do speculate along these lines, but I can't say that I know how long anyone's been down there. I think they've been down there for at least a couple of hundred years.
So
I think that.
Thinking of that idea of if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around to hear it, does it make a sound? If there are no human presence, do you believe these objects are even out in the middle of the ocean right now where there are no humans? Do you think then it's more a case that these are observational and they are in a location because we are there?
Yeah, that's another good speculative type of question. And I wonder about this a lot. And I don't have a firm answer, except to say that I think that at least a significant part of what they do probably has to do with us. Some people would say, well, that's ridiculous. Why would you think we're so important? Well, I say that because fundamentally, we're more like them probably than not. We, like them, are capable of abstract thought. We, like them, are capable of scientific thinking. We, like them, are capable of manipulating our environment to suit our needs. we, like them, are capable of destroying the planet. We're capable of doing a lot of things that they can do. Certainly not on their level, but again, they would see us, and I think they would probably recognize that as well. They would say, these humans, they're not like the other animals here. They are active, they're observant, they take notes, they write things down. They'll notice us and react to us if we are here. So hopefully they're thinking, let's not trample all over the garden and wreck their society. Let's play it cool. I like to think that's what they're probably doing. But I do think that we are an interest of theirs, yes.
You mentioned oceanography becoming a thing in the kind of 1870s. As a species, we develop sonar and early versions of it around the early 1900s. The First World War and Second World War have various iterations of this. Is there any evidence you have seen through your research that these objects have changed or adapted their behavior dependent on our technology?
Yes.
And detection methods changing?
Yes. In fact, this was something that was rather shocking to me when I began to review the data that I collected for this. So let me just back up and explain that. So in the course of doing this book, when I first started, my intention was simply to just write the stories out as best I could, maybe with some illustrations. But as I got really deep into it, actually, this is a suggestion of my wife, Tracy, where it became very important to this book. She said, you know, it would be really nice if for each of these cases, you were to have certain basic categories to make it easier for a reader to skim over. You know, what was it, a large object? What was it doing with the water? Was it under the water? Did it emerge from the water? What color was it? How close was the witness to it? And all of these things. And I thought, it's a great idea. I didn't want to do it at first because I knew it would be a lot more work, but I ended up going back over every single case and I extracted that data. One of the data points that I included was very simple. Did it happen during daytime or nighttime? It's not always easy to know, like, did it happen at 4 o'clock or 5 p.m. or things like that. But I could, for the most part, determine if it was during daylight or nighttime. And I thought, let's put that in as a factor. And I'm very glad I did. Because one thing that I saw very, very dramatically so was how, starting in the late 1960s, sightings went from roughly 50% daytime versus nighttime. Actually, a slight majority up until then were in the daytime. Following the late 1960s, it's almost like flipping a switch where 3/4 of them ever since have been at night. And there's a further distinction where between military and non-military encounters. So for example, in that earlier period prior to the late 60s, even though most of the total sightings were in the daytime, military sightings were predominantly at night by a factor of about 2/3, whereas civilian encounters were predominantly in the daytime by a large margin. After 1967, 68, military sightings, I think it's 87 or 88% of all of the military sightings have occurred at night, almost 90%. And also a large majority of civilian ones also at night. So somehow there is a behavioral change in these. And, you know, I mean, you could say, well, you need a bigger data sample. Well, I got 672 of these cases. I mean, it's not a bad data sample. I was simply trying to collect the best USO cases that I could find. That was my only criterion. And so on the basis of that, I'm seeing this very dramatic change in behavior. Why are they operating these USOs predominantly at night? That is a good question. I don't know that I have the exact answer, but I've speculated. One reason might be our own means of detecting them improved dramatically during the 1950s and 60s. Mm-hmm. We started developing an underground sonar system, especially the United States Navy, that was able to detect them in the water. We were developing satellites above the ground, you know, up in space, to detect these things. And all other kinds of instrumentation to see them in one way or another. And I wondered, I don't know if this is the reason or not, but for some reason, there was a massive global change in when they are appearing, and it's at night. So I wonder, were they trying to be a little bit more stealthy than before? Maybe. A couple of other things I noticed, that the patterns within the data made me really stand up and pay attention. One was in what we can call electromagnetic interference cases. This is really strange. So I got my first electromagnetic interference case for the USOs was 1951. That was the first one where it's very obvious the witnesses are saying the electricity went out, the compasses went wild, you know, this type of thing. So that was one factor that I looked for. Turns out from 1951 through the remainder, through 2024, 9.5% of all of the USO cases that I collected had some form of EM interference. It's almost 1 out of 10. It's quite a lot. But what makes it even more interesting is military cases had double that ratio. So 20% of military cases reported electromagnetic interference. And in the few instances where someone reported either missing time or sightings of some kind of beings connected with the ship or the craft, it was four times the amount. In other words, there were almost 40% of those cases reported electromagnetic interference. Now, this is not something that I was looking for in, you know, collecting these cases. I don't think that that's a random result. I think that that means something. And first of all, I think it speaks to probably the authenticity of these cases, that there is this type of consistency. But secondly, it speaks to behavioral aspects of the operators of these craft. So for example, if someone has had missing time and there's electromagnetic interference that was reported, maybe something really happened there. And maybe the operators of those craft genuinely did take this person for a period of missing time in the process screwing up some of their electronics. So there are things like this that I just found unexpected, but compelling when I would study them. So I'm really glad that I was able to do the categories, and then furthermore, take those categories and put them into a gargantuan, at least for me, spreadsheet that had all of this data fully available. And that spreadsheet, by the way, is a free download at my website. Anyone can get it. It's 37 pages. There's a lot there, but it's, you know, if you're a real nerd for this type of thing, and if you've read the book, that spreadsheet could be quite interesting and helpful.
Yeah, there's plenty of nerds listening to this podcast. Many of them get in touch with me, so they will love that. You mentioned, obviously, that as we go on through the decades, the equipment gets better, the sensors get better from a human perspective. We hear and have heard for many decades in ufology that radar can interfere with UFOs' systems, and perhaps this is a reason for many of these potential crashes, that it's our interference with their systems, or however those are working, that bring them down. Have you seen similar when it comes to sonar, for example, and potential interference with USOs?
I haven't seen any. I didn't collect any instances where sonar or our underwater technology resulted in the damage or incapacitation of a USO. It's possible that it happened. I didn't get any hint of that. However, there were instances in which it appeared, at least claims of things like USO retrieval attempts or operations. Yes, one case that I included in this book, I actually included it in an earlier book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, because this was a man that I personally spoke to. David Noble Whitehorse is his name. He's been publicly known. He was in the U.S. Navy in the early 1960s and told me, and has told many other people since, of when he was aboard a ship in the Pacific where there was an attempted retrieval of a object that came down from the sky, went into the ocean, was a failed retrieval attempt. And I did include that in my book. That went down from a nuclear test, a nuclear detonation. And that was his, what he stated. But in terms of other types of technology disabling these things, I did not see any indication of that, that like our sonar can inhibit them. I didn't see that.
Again, is that perhaps a nature of the environment of water and the medium of water, that you can see something fall out the sky and it lands in the desert and you go and pick it up with a winch, you know, and whatever, and retrieve the egg, as we've seen recently on video? Perhaps is much more difficult if something does fall out the sky. Is it falling? Is it leaving and entering the water of its own accord? And then how do you even begin to find it once it's down there as well?
I had a pretty long discussion in one of my later entries of that first volume about this whole procedure of USO retrieval, like how practical is it or not. I had one individual who wrote to me personally about the claim that actually the first nuclear-powered submarine, which was the USS Nautilus, that was commissioned in 1954, had nuclear power. It was the first. That in the mid-60s, the claim was that it did go through an upgrade, so it was refurbished due to some damage that it originally took on during a military test, but it was refurbished, and according to the claim, was given a certain hatch by which it would be capable of bringing in ocean-based disks that were of a certain size or smaller, so that it was in other words commissioned for USO retrieval. So I tried to explore this idea, and so what we could definitely say is that, first of all, the Nautilus was a somewhat small submarine by later standards. I don't know how useful it would have been for that. But even if it were used for that sort of thing, you're talking ocean shelf, not ocean floor. Because there's no way any of these subs are going to go down 15,000 feet to the bottom of the Atlantic or Pacific Ocean. They could not withstand that pressure. They can withstand down to maybe some of them as much as 1,000 feet. So that would cover most of the ocean shelves of this planet. That's about 10% of the ocean right there. Because if you think about it, you know, we've got shelves. In the case of North America, for example, we have a very large shelf extending, in some cases, a couple of hundred miles off the eastern United States coast. So you could engage in some type of operations that might involve a submarine. It's not impossible. We also have things like claws, big claws that can go down there, and they can actually go even deeper. They can go down to the ocean floor. So there are different ways of retrieving these things, if it were desirable, and I'm sure it would be desirable.
When it comes to the water itself, something we've not mentioned yet, but is touched upon within the book and has been talked about in lore, is aliens coming here or NHI to use water as an energy source. How often did you see this crop up in your research, that they're not just using it as a medium to travel or hide themselves, but perhaps as a fuel?
Yeah, there's a number of instances that I did collect and did include in which these objects appear to be, for example, there's like a, they'll be seen sucking up water.
Yeah.
So there's quite a few of those. In fact, I didn't even include all of those particular cases that I could have, but I did include a number of them. It was iffy to me, like, are they genuine USOs or not? If they're seen coming down and sucking up water, it's debatable. Maybe. I mean, I could have made the argument. I included some of those anyway, because they are interesting. And I thought they needed some attention. So yeah, there are instances where these objects, they create this kind of pillar of water. They're clearly somehow interacting with the water to the extent that they want it. They're collecting some of this water. Is that for energy? Is that for some other purpose? This I don't know. But there's little question that at least in some of these cases, the occupants or intelligences that are operating these craft, They want that water.
There's a beautiful illustration from Alan in one of them where a disc-shaped object, and I'm colorblind, but I think it's kind of blue or metallic, is sucking up the water. And that was one I looked at and thought that would make a really nice print for like a wall or something. I'll need to try and remember exactly where it was, but it was a really nice picture.
Hey, cool. I just have to tell you, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go on.
Tracy, I got my first copy of the book from Amazon. I didn't have a full copy of it, so it just came in the mail. I have one hardcover and one paperback.
I had the book before Richard did, yeah. And many of you who got in touch as well, so nice to see it's finally arrived.
It looks good. The color illustrations are gorgeous. Here we go. There's one. That's Adak Island, 1945. That's actually the particular case that got me started on this whole thing. Some of these are full page. This is one of the ghost rockets of 1946. I just love what Alan did here. That's just such a nice, what Alan did. I just have a moment to discuss his illustrations. What I love is that he brings the human beings into these events.
Yeah.
Most of these, you've got a human being accurately portrayed, like in he really took a lot of time to research the location, what that location looked like, what did people tend to wear, how did they, I think he did as careful a job as anyone could ask for in putting this together and putting the human being in these images, which I just loved.
Yeah,
that's exciting. I'm glad to get this.
It brings it to life beautifully. And on that as well, I'll be honest, you mentioned it was Sunday I received my copy. We were recording this on Wednesday. I've not had the chance to get through it. It's a gargantuan book, folks. A lot of work and effort has been put into this, and you can tell this is covering centuries alone just in this volume one, and it's worth the purchase. For you, I've not seen too many cases yet, just in flicking through what I've gone through. How often do beings appear? Because when it comes to USOs, it seems, especially in the past, it's always about the object. But how often do we see physical beings involved in cases or events?
They're in there, but it's rare. So again, I did, if you were to go to the back, the second appendix of that book, which is 35 pages, that appendix is a data analysis of all of the categories and things. So I actually spent a lot of time analyzing that data. And one thing that I do discuss there are sightings of beings and cases of alleged, we'll say, missing time. So beings have been sighted in, I think, about 3% total of all of these cases. So it's a small amount. Missing time is similar. So less than 5% for sure. But it does happen. There are some where there are beings, and you know, where there's almost 700 cases, even that amounts to like 15 or so cases where there are beings sighted throughout, and they're in there, but it's rare.
For you, Richard, what are some of your favorite cases from the book that maybe stand out, that are a little bit different to the rest?
Oh man, I honestly, I love some of these cases. I love them just because they, I would say just about every case in this book could practically be made into a 30-minute documentary. Some of them could be made into a movie. I think they're just that incredible. They're that cool. When you get into all of the factors that are involved, like what's going on in the witness's mind, what's going on, what is going on in the mind of these occupants? Sometimes I wonder about this. What actually is going on? So there's a few cases that are just absolute favorites of mine. One, I have mentioned publicly once or twice before, but I just want to mention here because I love it. And in fact, Alan did an illustration of it. A married couple, an American couple in 1955, the family name was Bordas. We know we have their name. And they lived just north of New York City, about 30 miles north of New York City, which in 1955, there was a lot of beautiful nature that was there. And one thing they loved to do was night fishing. They love to do it. This is a fun little thing that they did. So they're out at a small reservoir, like a lake, maybe 2 miles in length, a half a mile in width. At midnight, they're alone and they're night fishing in this ultra quiet place surrounded by trees. It had to be very, very dark. And this is what they did. So they hear a splash and they look and they see this rose-colored basketball-sized glowing object rise from the water. So right away, that's interesting. There were two elongated tube-like lights that were bluish white, about 30 feet wide, each of them, along with this basketball light. And they were above the water. So they're on the shore looking at this, and the husband says to the wife, "I'm going to get into the rowboat and row out. I want to see this." The wife thought he was crazy. You can just see this scene happening. But he does row out there. As he's rowing out toward it, the object, or the lights, we could say, moved away from him at a speed faster than he was able to row. And by the way, on this lake or reservoir, no boats other than rowboats were allowed on this body of water. So no motorboats were allowed. But whatever this was moving farther away from him. So he decided, well, I'll just row back to my wife. So he gets back to shore, but then they decide to go home, but they parked one full mile from where they were. They had to get into their boat and row a mile to their parking lot. And while they're doing this, the lights are following them, at times illuminating their boat and illuminating them the whole way. I would love to have seen the entire mile-long row that they went through during this whole thing while they got back to their car. Even in the parking lot, they were able to see this. That couple was interviewed very shortly after this by an active investigative group at the time known as Civilian Saucer Investigation, CSI. They were, for a little while in the 50s, they were quite active and very good. They wrote an extended report analysis of this, interviewed these witnesses at great length, found them very credible. It's a pretty well-researched and well-regarded case that unfortunately was just completely forgotten after it happened. Another one that I love from this volume, I mentioned the Adak Island case. It's off the Aleutian Islands from 1945. It was the case that started me on this whole journey. And I do think it's an incredible case. At the end of World War II, or in the summer of 1945, Japan is still fighting. Germany is not. An American transport vessel returning from Japan to Seattle. It's traversing the northern Pacific there by the Aleutian Islands. One of those islands is known as Adak Island, A-D-A-K. And the members of this ship saw, apparently, a disc-shaped saucer emerge from the ocean, circle around their ship a couple of times, and then zip off, leaving some bright lights in its wake. One of the members of that ship, some years later, maybe 15 years later, 20 years later, spoke to a number of UFO researchers about this, including atmospheric physicist Dr. James McDonald, who was a very well-known researcher at that time, a brilliant man. It seems like a very good case. And 1945, an object coming out of the water. There are just so many of these that that I find utterly fascinating. I don't know if I could even describe all. One other I'll mention concerning a U.S. aircraft carrier, the USS Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It was a very, very important aircraft carrier back in the 1950s and 60s, and was decommissioned in the 70s. So the FDR had, in its career, had many UFO encounters, actually, and many USO encounters. One that came to us through one of the officers of the ship from 1954. He wrote anonymously, but in great detail, to the online magazine, you could say, of Filer's Files, run by U.S. Air Force Major George Filer, who's still with us, still around. And he's collected these for years and years. So this came to Filer's Files. The guy wrote a very detailed description of what happened in 1954. He didn't give the location. He didn't give his name. He left a number of details out, but he was very explicit about how the FDR was in a cigar-shaped object, descended, a very large one, disabled all of their electronics and communications and weapons systems. They were not able to launch any fighter aircraft, apparently, and they tried to. Two disc-shaped objects came out of the water and eventually merged with the cigar-shaped object, which at the end of the encounter descended into the water, according to this man. He gave a minute-by-minute account, literally a minute-by-minute account. Very meticulous. He actually stated he was one of the officers of the ship. He wasn't just an enlisted guy. He was an officer. I think that's an incredible account. I did a lot of research into the FDR, and I couldn't figure out what body of water it was in. But what I learned is that in 1954, the FDR, which was frequently stationed in the Mediterranean Sea, was traveling to Seattle, Washington, for what would be a two-year overhaul. And I learned it was too big to fit through the Panama Canal. So the FDR had to go out the Mediterranean, down the Atlantic Ocean, around the tip of South America, up the other side, the Pacific side, to Seattle. It had a very, very long route. And it was somewhere along that transport that it engaged this USO or these UFOs. Amazing, amazing stuff.
Do you think as a species, given you've spent 3 years plus on this book now and done so much research, should we focus more on exploring our own oceans than we should looking off into space and the stars?
In looking for UFOs or UAP, you mean?
Just in general, as a species, you know, we seem to be trying to go off. Let's go back to the moon. Let's try and get here. We seem to explore so much less the oceans. Yet here is a full book, which is just a part of the evidence you've managed to look through and present, and all this data to say there's all these incredible things under the water. Why aren't we going down there to explore?
Well, it's very difficult. The pressures are very, very difficult for us to navigate and manage. When you get down to the bottom of the Pacific Ocean, this is not easy to do. Our submarines cannot go down that far. Certainly no human divers can go down that far. It's just not possible. The pressures are too great. Human divers are able to go down maybe, I mean, if you're a real pro, maybe 300 feet. And even that's a stretch, usually 200 feet. So we're not even going down a fraction of a mile as divers. Now, you go down in certain submersibles, you can, but it's not easy. So that's one thing. In my view, the only real way that we would be able to have a kind of ability to stay down there in an extended way would be if we were to create a kind of you have to create a very stable undersea environment, either literally under the ocean floor or inside like an ocean mountain, for example. That could happen. That I could imagine we would have the ability to do. And then you'd have a secure base of operations in there. Oxygen conceivably might not be a problem if you're able to do electrolysis from the water. This is what submarines do, nuclear subs, which stay under the water for many, many months at a time. They're not carrying around a bunch of oxygen tanks. They're extracting oxygen from the water. So we know how to do that. And we probably can do a lot of other things. If you find like a nice geothermal source, that could be an energy source. Or you could bring a local portable nuclear device down there for your energy, conceivably. Like, there are ways of doing it. So I don't think that's impossible. And I could imagine that there would be some motivation, at least from a military perspective. You could see militaries wanting to do this. And it's possible. I wouldn't even say it's impossible that some of the militaries of this world, US, may be doing this without anyone knowing. I would never rule that out. Is it easier or harder than going out into space? That's a good question. I don't know. I think they're both very difficult. They're both very tough. And, you know, there used to be a lot of futuristic accounts from a century or more ago, early 20th century, late 19th century, where I read some of these. I watched, looked at some really cool, crazy pictures where, you know, these futurists back then thought, oh, yeah, we'll be able to live down in the ocean,
yep,
just like above the surface. And it's kind of funny to see just how naive some of these thoughts really were. It's a lot more difficult. But to your question, like, I don't think that it's impossible. Is it more advantageous or not than to go off world is a question that I don't know if I have the answer to that one. That's a good question. It's worth thinking about.
What I'd like to do before we get to listener questions, which cover the USO topic, I want to sidebar quickly and get your thoughts on some modern, current, up-to-date, state-of-play UFO questions, and then we'll get back to the USO topic and finish off there. A whole lot has happened in the last few months, Richard, that I'd love to get your take on. First off, the task force that has just been set up by Congress, looking into a number of what, let's be fair, the general public will call conspiracy theories.
Yes.
So UFOs, 9/11, COVID, the Bin Laden death, JFK, Martin Luther King, the Epstein list. As a task force with a six-month window to uncover the greatest secrets in modern history being set up to fail. That is all for part one. Part two will be out in the next couple of days. You can listen to this episode already in full, ad-free and with no sponsors for less than the price of a coffee. If you head on over to Patreon or Apple, you can subscribe to the podcast for less than the price of a coffee or take up the 2 weeks free trial that are available on those platforms. You can head on over to Spotify and search That UFO Podcast Premium and get access to this episode in full, no adverts, no sponsorships, and also with some extra bonus content as well. Thanks for listening, folks.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
From the office to a first date, there's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every situation. But clothes don't make the man. With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. They combine timeless style with modern performance materials to keep you looking good and feeling comfortable all day, no matter what's on today's agenda. Browse everything from shorts and polos to sweats and crews. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com, promo code MACK25.